Welcome to Threaded Minds, Law and Beyond with Sohaib Zada. This podcast is your space to explore the intersections of law, business, personal growth, and modern life. I'm your host, Sohaib Zada, a legal expert, educator, practitioner, and lifelong learner. Together, we will unravel the threads that shape our world. From legal principles to career strategies, self-development, and the challenges of our interconnected world. We dive deep to uncover stories and insights that matter. Let us connect the dots and discover new perspectives. This is Threaded Minds, where every thread leads to a story and every story sparks a new idea. Welcome to Threaded Minds. In today's episode, we have a special exceptional guest that I promised you I'm gonna have in this show. I have Erica Werneman Root, a legal consultant with expertise in AI, privacy, and compliance. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm happy to have you here in the show. All right. So today we are going to explore Erica's career journey and how her work in consulting has evolved over the years. There are very interesting key themes that we will cover in this episode. For example, what early career lawyers ask, what are the evolving challenges that we have in privacy and compliance. Before we begin, I would like to start with just a simple question. I have a question about your career journey. Could you walk us through your career journey and how your work in privacy and, for example, in consulting has evolved over the years?
Yes, of course. So I am going way, way back. I actually studied economics and then I did a conversion degree to law. I am trained and qualified with a city law firm in London, originally actually as a litigator. So I worked in disputes. And then in the run-up to GDPR, a lot of my clients were technology clients. And I just thought the topic was quite fascinating. So I slowly pivoted across rather than sort of an abrupt change. I then spent some time in the Middle East. I was out in Dubai for about, 6 years. And in that capacity, I supported the wider MEA region. So I worked across the Middle East, Africa, sort of bridging or linking the different threads between Asia sometimes and Europe and UK, which is great fun. I returned to the UK, kept working in data protection primarily, but increasingly also in artificial intelligence. So I spent some time on government boards looking at AI ethics before the EU AI Act came out. And generally, I was sort of emerging tech was an area that I found fascinating. So early on, I looked at cryptos, blockchains, various forms of AI, facial recognition, driverless vehicles. It's similar. If there was something quite techy, I tended to try to get involved from a data protection perspective. And then I did that. I ended up spending a decade in private practice. I spent some time on remote secondments to major global players. I worked with some early stage companies. And I think it's such a common story, isn't it? But I love my time at the firm. I was there for, like I said, a decade and quite happily on a partnership. Sort of that's what I saw in my future. And then had my son and realized actually I could do with a different pace of life. So I was headhunted. I was recruited for a startup. So I did that for a while. It sort of dawned on me relatively early on that startups perhaps don't need someone like me full time. They need me to come in and put the infrastructure in place. So after a bit of time with the startup, I took the leap and I set up my own company. So I've been working as a consultant by my own business for about a year and a half now.
That's very nice. Actually, this is fascinating. When you look at your resume and you see, like, for example, you study economics and then you moved into the law. I think that's what's important, to combine multiple areas, multiple majors, and try to come up with a niche area where the clients need your legal services or what you could offer them. And it's actually interesting. I noticed that in your resume, you worked with Evershed Sutherland, and then you moved into your own practice. So probably you have good knowledge about the differences between working for a law firm and starting your own, I would say, boutique law firm or your own business, providing legal consultancy and services. It's interesting, worldwide in many jurisdictions nowadays, you can actually practice law without a law degree. For example, in the UK, they opened a route, SQE, for people to practice law. You just need 2 years of legal practice and then two exams, SQE 1 and 2, and you can be qualified as a solicitor. I'm not sure, but I heard about California. There is another route for that. So you can see there is a shift in the legal education or the competencies that law societies or regulators expect in the le future legal professionals. So we'll see more updates. We may see updates with regards to the required qualifications. So it doesn't need for some people to start with a law degree. And even if you start with a law degree, you need to prove that you're competent in a specific area by training and having multiple experiences as you did in different locations. It's very interesting.
I
Okay.
think just sort of building on that for a second, I'm actually increasingly working with people that are not in the legal profession. So in particular around AI, there are, I think, multiple paths into the profession. So I'm seeing people come in with a philosophy background that are looking more towards the ethics aspect. Obviously, in compliance, you don't have to be a legal, although many people are, you don't have to be a lawyer. So you can come from a compliance background, a governance background, a risk background. So I'm sort of interacting with people from many different backgrounds these days.
I know, especially with AI, I'm doing my thesis in crypto trading platforms and the interconnection with securities compliance. And I find out with these new fields, we need experienced people from different backgrounds, whether it's law, ethics, social science, economics. But the problem, the people from public law or human rights or some areas, they don't understand the terms or our specialty. So they think we are creating something innovative or something that doesn't exist. I find it challenging talking about my field sometimes.
Interesting.
All right. I know that you often get approached by students or early career lawyers or aspiring lawyers or solicitors, whether it's on LinkedIn, on social media. So what are the main, if you can summarize for us, like the main questions that those people ask with regards to their profession, to their practice in the future?
I think there's broadly speaking two different themes. There are people that are asking about particular skills or what they can do to stand out, certifications, generally around upskilling and I guess being an attractive either employee or somebody who could perhaps make a change into the profession from a different practice area. And I think the other section of queries I tend to get is more around, I don't know, like a crystal ball. Like, what do I think about the future? Is it worth going into this area or that area? What are the risks? Is the profession going to change? Are the roles going to be very different? So I guess those are the two sort of broad thematic issues that people tend to reach out about. And I try to respond as much as I can.
What do you typically respond to them? What advice you offer to them?
It's a good question, right? So I think it depends. When people look at my career, a lot of people assume there were some strategic decisions I made along the way. I didn't. I was just along for the ride. I made different decisions based on what felt right at the moment. There wasn't some overarching plan to my career. And if I had to say anything, I think your early career is for testing different things and seeing what you enjoy, what you're good at. I think people try to plan 10, 15, 20 years in advance, and that's just not how careers unfold. Sometimes I've stayed in positions longer than I intended to because I enjoyed the people. Sometimes I just put my hand up and randomly got sent off on an assignment and discovered I really enjoyed it. So I think you can try to pick up new skills. You can certainly be a little bit sensible about it, but I don't think you can really plan a 20, 30-year career as an early stage professional. So find what you enjoy and what you're good at. And in terms of the skills, I think they're now, you mentioned some of the different areas, right? Increasingly, I'm seeing roles open up in legal tech companies. I think that would be a fascinating space to be in. I think going straight in-house will give you a different kind of skill sets. That is increasingly, I think, in demand in private practice as well, if you can sort of bridge the gap between the technology and the law. In terms of the long-term view, nobody knows. And if they tell you they know, I would just call bullshit on that. Like nobody really knows. You see trends and you can make some good informed guesses about how things are going to unfold. But if I had to make predictions 5 years ago, I don't think anything would have been really spot on. So I think it's more, rather than trying to future-proof your career by taking certain steps, again, think it's better to find out what you're good at and what you enjoy and sort of try to follow those paths.
I do believe, actually, this is a great idea. I do believe you need to start getting the training, the hand-on approach to see what where you find your passion. Because I remember myself when I graduated from law school, I didn't have that passion for technology law and securities law, and then I found this path. So some people may take years, may take months to find out where they can, find their passion or the area they want to practice. And most importantly, I think, we won't see as much as in the past with regards to general practices, like in the morning family law, in the afternoon criminal law, and in the evening one case in, for example, commercial law or contracts. I do think we'll see more specialized people, more niche areas, and I do believe that's what the legal profession requires at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's different views on that as well. I think you're probably right. And certainly from the sort of city perspective that I've always worked in, that's always been the case. But in a lot of scenarios, it's also understanding, having a broad exposure, understanding different kinds of implications and how they might unfold. And then speaking to the passion point, I think this is something I don't really see. Trainees or younger professionals really think about. As I get along in my career and I work with these really impressive people, a lot of the time they might work in an area that to an outsider would seem quite dull, but they enjoy it because they're so good at it. So I think there's two sides to the passionate. You can pick an area that you're passionate about and develop skills in it. But I think if you stick in an area, as you become more proficient and better, I think you also find passion in those areas. So it's sort of the depth of knowledge and the mastery of a topic makes you passionate about it, if that makes sense. So I don't think you have to go around chasing your passions necessarily to have a fulfilling career. You can also just build your understanding and your knowledge. I think a lot of people then become passionate as a result.
Interesting. And let's say as an early career professional or an aspiring lawyer, I found my path in intellectual property or AI or compliance. Do you expect over the years of your experience, do you expect from that lawyer or professional to know everything about that field or what's required? What's the main skill that lawyer should have?
Nobody knows everything. They really, really don't. And I think it's one of the, I think it causes a lot of anxiety, and not just in early stage professionals, people that have been established in their career, because the pace of change, it feels like everything is speeding up. And I've seen and heard people struggle a little bit with it. They feel like if they can just read a few more articles, attend a few more conferences, read up on all of those things they've saved in their inbox, all of the different LinkedIn posts, etc., then they'll finally arrive and know what they need to do, know for their profession. And that is just, it is wishful thinking because you're never going to know everything. Certainly not in the early stage of your career, but also not when as your career progresses, there's too much information in the world. So I think the key here is knowing what to prioritize. And it's quite liberating when you take that approach, because it was never the case that you can know everything in a domain. And I think increasingly now we're just seeing how unrealistic that is, which is in itself sort of agency producing, because you get to pick what you're going to focus on. You get to pick and prioritize, and you're never going to get across, like, even though I spend all day, every day, pretty much reading about AI, it's a snippet of all the information that's out there. So I think you need to get good at realizing where you can find information when you need it and what to prioritize. And I think those are really the only decisions you can make.
Yeah, I agree. I think also with the fields of AI or some unprecedented areas, we don't have frameworks in some jurisdictions. So even if you try to find legal frameworks, you have to make analysis and try to compare with existing frameworks or look at some best practices internationally. I do believe it's very important for legal professionals to look into the technology aspect and to get some training in the business field. For example, for people who start their own business, they need to get training in the marketing, in accounting, in how to bill clients, and all of these aspects. And that doesn't happen for people who work under a law firm. They just focus on the legal work and meeting the clients. So I do believe it depends on varies from an individual to an individual. What's important is to know where to get the information from and what are the available resources in your area.
Yes, I think that's spot on. And you know, with the increased prevalence of people using AI to generate content that sounds plausible, I think one of the key skills will also be to be able to tell quality from AI generated content. And that is actually slightly trickier than it sounds, because what platforms like ChatGPT, what they produce, it sounds credible. And unless the domain, you might not spot the errors. So I think one of the skills is coming back to basics, what we were taught at university, right? References, checking, quality checking, etc. I think that's also quite important. So knowing where to look, who to trust, that will get you, I think, quite far down the line.
Interesting. That would lead us to another to the second topic of this episode, talking about AI. I know we are in the world of AI now. As a legal professional, should I rely on it? Should I look into some, for example, models that have been trained by legal professionals? What's the fine line between using it or some people, I know people, they don't rely or don't believe they should use it.
I use it a lot. I like it. I got all of them. I've got Claude, I got Perplexity, ChatGPT, Notebook LM. I'm constantly sort of testing them and checking. I'll put the same question in all of them to see what kind of responses I get and to get a sense of what they're good at, what they're not so good at. And I think I hate looking at a blank screen when I'm writing a report or anything. I'd much rather have something and then change the whole thing. For me, that's just an easier way of working. And you can always find snippets in it. I think the key or the risks here is knowing what you can and what you can't put in there. So don't put confidential information, don't put personal data. I didn't even put identifiers, but I do use it for research quite a lot. But I guess the difference here is, when it gives me something that is incorrect, I feel like I spot it immediately. So some of the safest ways of using AI is actually by domain level experts, because they immediately see what's wrong. Even if it sounds plausible, it's not going to work because of this other thing that AI didn't consider. So, I mean, I would use it as a Google, have it help you with research, have it formulate answers, but then check and double check everything. I think that's the sensible thing to do, and speak to more experienced colleagues.
I do think it's using AI is similar to using Google. It reminds me of the early years of when Google came into place. It's the same level, the same method. However, over-relying on AI without putting the efforts into writing, into refining, putting your writing style is problematic. As you said, you may use it as an administrative assistant that helps with outlining, reframing, putting some feedback, revising, reviewing. Although models differ and some of them are better than others, I'm aware that LexisNexis is working on an AI model for the legal profession, and we'll see more models in the future designed specifically for lawyers. And we may find something very powerful. And for example, they may have access to the database and they can provide authentic and reliable answers. And it would be very helpful for me when I research an AI. I always like to ask for quotes from the file, so I go to verify that information myself.
I think people develop different shorthands and ways of working with AI, but I would say it is definitely something to test and try, even if you don't rely on the responses, even though you feel like it's not super reliable. I think by just having a bit of a play around with it, you get a sense of what's possible, and they do get better. So the models that I've been using, like comparing them to 6 months ago or a year ago, it's a different proposition. So I think just getting that feel for how you work with them. And there's a whole sort of industry around prompt engineering and how you get it to actually give you quality responses. I don't think it would be wasted time spending a little bit of effort sort of just understanding what is a good prompt and how do you get the kind of results you want.
And have a backup plan, because sometimes there might be outage or some issues, so you need to have your own precedence, and that goes to the point of over-relying on it. I know now people talk about AI and compliance, especially from an organization perspective. How do you think organizations should approach compliance using AI or utilizing AI tools?
So I think so. There's probably two different questions, sort of snowballed or rolled into one. Then there's the question of what you need to do from a compliance perspective to manage organizational AI. So this is AI that's across the business, right? And then there is the question of how do you use AI to support a compliance team? So slightly different, but they go hand in hand sometimes, not always. Was there a particular angle you wanted to look at out of those two, or? Just roll with both.
These two, the main uses for AI and also how to utilize it for compliance
Yeah.
purposes.
So I think it all depends on the kind of organization you're working with. Is it early stage? Is it larger, more sophisticated? Is it quite agile? So there's very rarely a one size fits all. But understanding, I think, where the business is at in terms of technical capabilities, appetite, and what they're generally doing. So I work with AI developers. I work with very sophisticated clients, but I also work with clients that are just sort of testing stuff. So I think having the right kind of infrastructure, one of the GCs I work with, he always talks about right sizing everything. So you don't want to go overboard, but you also don't want to be exposed to too many risks. So if you're at a company that's just sort of exploring, what you want to have is infrastructure for safe pilots and innovations without going over the top, right? But if you are at more sophisticated players, you probably want a bit of a governance structure around it. So that's when we get into the remit of responsible AI, AI governance. It has many, many different names. And that's more about the corporate, sort of the management system or the corporate structure that supports a more wide-scale use and adoption of AI. So we can dig into that for sure. But just to touch briefly on the other use case. So I feel like maybe this is my perspective, but I feel like compliance teams and legal teams are just being asked to do more and more and more. So I had just before Christmas, 20 different risk assessments for Copilot or something like that. There's an increased volume. And I think not right now, perhaps, but over the next year, I think there'll be increasing use cases for exploring how you deploy AI within a compliance setting. And there's some, pretty low risk, lower hanging fruit here. You could use it. Most companies have Teams or Slack or some kind of internal communication channel. One use case that I know lots of companies have explored and are using is essentially training a chatbot on your corporate compliance procedures and policies. It's usually not super sensitive. I can't tell you how many times I get pinged just to help people find a policy or explain a policy. So it could take off a bit of the demand of compliance teams if you had some kind of automated feature that will answer general questions about where's our policy, what's our limits on X, et cetera. And I definitely know of different companies that are doing that already. And I feel like that's a good way of checking or testing out different processes. But then as you get more sophisticated, there's potentially much bigger tools. You can automate aspects of your records of processing activities. You can meeting notes. You can do all kinds of different things with it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. AI is on the fields. One of the main areas is managing the organization's operations and the works that organization works. And for example, I've seen like transcribing meetings and putting agendas or next actions after the meeting. I mean, there are many uses for AI and the compliance field, risk assessment. Although I probably you can't get the verdict or the overall judgment from AI, but figuring out the potential risk in specific area is one use of AI. There are multiple angles in looking at AI. But what excites you the most about AI advancements and compliance?
Oof. What excites me the most? I think it's interesting, novel ways of working. I think from a personal perspective, because of the work I do, which is largely focused around AI literacy, building the infrastructure, I feel like I'm learning a lot. So with AI literacy, there's aspects of it that's AI strategy based, so sort of where's the direction of the company going? There's the general compliance and risk management and legal aspects to it. There's the upskilling and learning. I feel like for the first time, people in my career, people are coming to me for corporate training materials. And normally it's the case that you're legal and compliance, we have to chase people to say, you have to finish this training module, sit down, do this 1 hour. Versus now, it's almost the case that the business is sort of, they want to get access to tools. They want to understand how it impacts their work. They want to try things out. So increasingly I'm seeing the business coming to legal and compliance saying, can we get training on X? Can we get training on, all of these different aspects? And that's really cool because you have an opportunity here to upskill people with real world skills that they need for their job and that they see a personal value in at the same time as you can weave in some of the threads around the legal risks. So helping them understand contextually what are the risks in the role that I'm doing or with the kind of systems I'm working on or with the decisions I'm making. So you can sort of integrate it in a much more natural way, which I think is fascinating. So I'm doing a lot of exploring around what AI literacy looks like for different companies and also how you deliver it. Because corporate training, like the once a year tick box exercise, is fundamentally a defense for the company. So we've given the training, we've done our bit. Okay, they didn't follow it. That's their problem. Not really, but you get it. You know what I mean, right? But if you're talking about upskilling and getting people to actually start using different tools in new ways, that's not a theoretical piece of knowledge. That's an applied piece of knowledge. So looking at how you change training and learning in the corporate environment, I think is also a very fascinating topic.
I think even with document management, which is a very important field with drafting policies, contracts, AI can help with changing the frameworks and looking at some improvement areas where we can develop. Or even with drafting contracts, you look for a clause, you want to change something, you can look at previous works. This is an interesting field that AI could come in place with. I tested AI with risk management, and I find some of the information provided very useful in figuring out what are the potential risks and how to address these risks, although the final judgment should be by the risk assessor. I know AI is trained by humans, so there are many challenges, and at the same time, we've seen some of the opportunities as we discussed earlier. However, what do you think, or what are your thoughts on potential risk of using or introducing AI to the legal field? How should senior legal professionals or lawyers address these risks by, for example, working side by side with programmers?
So we have a concept of guardrails. So when you're doing something with AI, you try to limit the potential downside and the risk aspect of something going wrong. So I think as long as you have a, again, you have to, AI is all about context, right? So if the risk of getting something wrong is going to really impact a person's health, their well-being, their livelihood, that's a significant decision and that requires quite considered thought. It requires quite considered testing, etc. That's completely different from somebody that wants to use it in a low risk capacity. So say you want to have an AI system for, I don't know, for predicting stock shortages for your shop. Maybe that's a solution, right? So it automatically places orders for toothpaste when it on certain market signals and is adaptive and is smart. What's the risk going to be, like realistically? So perhaps that it goes haywire and orders a million pieces of or tubes of toothpaste when you didn't when you needed 10. So I think understanding where you sit in that spectrum of risk will help you really inform what kind of risks you can take, what kind of, things need safeguards, other things don't. So understanding the risk profile of the project would always be my starting point. And then you look at things like, okay, so this is the nature of the risk profile for the project. What about the risk appetite for the company? What about the jurisdiction you're in? Are there specific requirements? Does the law specify something that we need to achieve or not do, right? So you sort of you take a layered approach to it in deciding what you can and cannot test. So coming full circle to your question around, well, what about lawyers wanting to use it? If you want to use it for a bit of research and test out, can it help you draft a memo without putting client details, confidential information, personal data? Like that's not particularly high risk. That's something people can test out. Depending on the size of your firm, you might want to do it in a corporate environment. There are restrictions typically on the kind of AI you can use for your company. But you have to have a bit of common sense, I think. And as lawyers, if you understand where the risk domains are, so confidential information, IP, data protection, and sort of trying to build frameworks around obviously giving the wrong advice will be a major one as well. But understand what the risk profile is for your professional, what you're trying to do, then you can look at what kind of safeguards you need to put in place.
Yeah, fascinating. I think the main thing is probably one way of training the, as a human being, we face a constant challenge of being neutral and not biased. How to transfer this to the machine, this is actually can be challenging, especially when you ask the machine to provide a direct related answer. That's the main
Oh,
challenge.
for sure. Yes. I mean, even with things like that, you can have quite lengthy conversations with people and then realize you're talking about completely different things, right? So bias has a meaning. That term means something for lawyers, and we're primarily thinking about discrimination when we talk about bias. Bias means something different in statistics. It means something different in machine learning. It means something different in the context of engineering, right? So we're not necessarily talking about the bad kind of discrimination that lawyers are concerned about. It can mean different things. So with terms like that, it helps to understand what who you're talking to and what they understand, because not some bias is necessary for machine learning. So otherwise, you want a machine. So say you're trying to sort origins from bananas. You wanted to have a bias towards having round things labeled as orange. That's just a crazy example, but you know what I mean, right? So it's not always the bad thing that lawyers are thinking about. However, in the event that it is, there's actually quite a lot of guidance out there that will help. So it's one of those areas that regulators across the board have been quite alive to. So you can look at, for instance, UK ICO has very detailed guidance around fairness, they call it. So it's slightly broader than just bias, but looking at fairness aspect, there's a lot of reports that have been written. There's increasingly a lot of technical standards that will assess bias. So again, I think it's probably the case of having doing some reading, understanding the landscape of what bias it is, what the risks are, what the frameworks are, and then knowing where to find the information depending on what you need to understand. But for sure, what to your point around it's based on human input. Yes, in the sense that it's trained on data that is probably biased. It's trained on historical data. So there's a lot to consider there. There's some excellent books on the topic as well. So I think just getting a handle on what it is, how machine learning or AI works, how the large language models, how they work, and what the nature of their bias looks like in different domains, I think that's quite helpful.
I know the topic is long and we can have hours covering the main
We sure can.
AI. Just wanted to have an introductory episode with you to discuss potential opportunities for AI and to discuss some concerns that early career professionals or lawyers would have in the law. I would be very happy to have you again in the show. Thank you so much for all of your
Thank
answers
you.
and for the detailed guidance for early career professionals. You did a great job and hopefully we have you again in the show.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for tuning in to Threaded Minds, Law and Beyond. I hope today's episode offered valuable insights and inspired new ideas. Stay part of the conversation by following us on Instagram and sharing your thoughts. We always appreciate hearing from you. Remember to leave a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, whether it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts, so you never miss an episode. Join me next time as we continue exploring the threads that connect law, business, and life. Until then, this is Sohaib Zada. See you on Threaded Minds.